name is Scott Hasserud, and this is a session entitled Carl Jung, Dreams and Revelation. And what I'd like to do is, first of all, is to share with you some thoughts, and hopefully I won't be so long-winded this morning, and we'll have plenty of time for conversation and questions. But in order to set the stage for talking about God, dreams, and revelation, I'd like to talk just for a moment about our contemporary worldview, which has been largely rationalistic, mechanistic, and materialistic. We have mostly grown up believing that reality is what our five senses tell us that it is. And this worldview has precluded the existence or made it difficult for us to believe in the existence of a non-material, psychic, or even spiritual world. Even though we are people of faith, we've had actually a hard time believing in that. Or believing what we experienced was equally as real as the physical world. It's really fascinating to study to trace the development of our worldview, which has conditioned our theology, our psychology, and our own personal perspectives on our own religious experience. That's a subject for another time, and if you're interested in that particular subject, then I would particularly recommend to you the writings of people like Morton Kelsey. He is a very prolific writer. He's retired now, but for many years a professor at Notre Dame, University of Notre Dame, an Episcopalian priest, and a student of Jung for many years of his life. It's enough for now to say that we have been raised in an era where the ideal of certainty has been based on logic, not on experience. What we have been led to believe is that logic can lead us to an understanding of what is certain, as opposed to what we experience. We have devalued our experience. For example, people who consider themselves to be non-religious people use logic to persuade themselves that God does not exist. Liberal Christians use logic to point out contradictions in Orthodox Christianity and develop their own metaphysical speculations. And fundamentalist Christians, who supposedly base their theology on a personal experience with a personal God, are actually the most rationalistic of all, developing logical theologies that hold together from beginning to end. Consequently, Jung stated that the church, instead of supporting people's religious experience, has often become a defense against their own religious experiences, because of the one-sided rational viewpoint. For us to talk seriously about God, dreams, and revelation, we have to develop, in my opinion, a much more holistic worldview that allows belief in both the material and non-material reality, where there is certainly room for sense, experience, and logic on the one hand, but also, on the other hand, an encounter with mystery, with the numinous, with irrationality, I actually prefer the word non-rationality, and the psyche. Esther Harding wrote back in 1959, "The symbols of Christianity have lost their power to influence humankind because they have been undermined by the rationalistic spirit and scientific materialism of the last 150 years in Western thought. As a result, people no longer feel the need to participate in the mysteries of their religion." We see some movement away from that now. I think the non-rational realities are gaining in terms of being valued in our time, but we still suffer from a very one-sided view. It's interesting that into this kind of worldview has come in recent times the whole charismatic renewal movement and so forth. Unfortunately, with that movement, it has not necessarily brought people to larger consciousness. And so I suppose only time will tell what the impact of that is. Well, let's talk about God. If we are to be helpful to each other in our experience of God, we need to set aside once and for all the belief that God, of course, is an entity exclusively up in the sky or out there somewhere that enters our existence whenever he or she wills or whenever we will it. Freud was probably right when he said that this sky God carries all our projected infantile dependency needs and is an illusion. Rather, we need to see and understand and believe and experience God as an entity not equal to, but definitely involved in our psychic, physical life and processes. God is not just out there. God is very much in here, in us, in between us, involved in all of the psychic, physical realities that we live in the midst of. We need to open ourselves up to the possibility of experiencing God as, in the terms of Paul Tillich, as the very ground of our being. Here Jung is helpful to us because he helps us ground God in our own inner being. Jung once wrote, "Religious experiences are facts which demonstrate the existence of an authentic religious function in the unconscious. The fact is that certain ideas exist almost everywhere. They are not made up by the individual. They happen to him or her. They even force themselves on our consciousness. Religion is a term that designates the attitude peculiar to consciousness which has been changed by the experience of the holy." In other words, when we experience the holy, or what Jung called the noumenosium, that's a term that he stole from Rudolf Otto, it changes our conscious viewpoint about things. An experience of God changes our conscious viewpoint. So if we can develop a holistic worldview that includes both physical and psychic dimensions, both rational and non-rational sides, both consciousness and unconsciousness, all the opposites, if we can begin to imagine God in the midst of all of this, then perhaps we are ready to consider how God reveals herself, himself, to us in some fresh ways. Now, when we speak about revelation, we are speaking about that which we do not yet know and we are waiting for. And this is an interesting discussion between me and other theologians, so you have to understand that this is Scott Hasserud speaking. In my opinion, revelation in the past is of historical interest to us, and we use it to amplify and clarify and position ourselves. But the messages we need from God that will help us take the next step in our life, the messages we need to get in step with God's will, we do not now know them. But we wait for them as an These messages come to us as symbolic messages from the unconscious, and they seize us. Out of the darkness comes the light, the scripture says. But Jung writes, "This seizure or sensed or presumed existence of a power outside consciousness which seizes the person is a miracle par excellence. What is it that for thousands of years has wrung from man the greatest spiritual effort, the loveliest works of art, the profoundest devotion, the most heroic self-sacrifice. What else but a miracle? It is a miracle which is not man's to command. I, of course, would add that this has something to do with the grace of God. Well, this leads us finally then to the dream. One of the major mediums of God's revelation, in my opinion, is the dream. It is interesting to note that in the scriptures, the great prophets accepted this fact without question. But today, because of our limited worldview, we question the value of the symbols God gives us through our unconscious processes. We have trivialized that. We say it's emotional trivia and don't take it seriously. Okay. That's kind of, I wanted to lay for you the groundwork of the assumptions about why I think dreams are so important. Not all dreams are of great importance. I mean, we have little dreams and big dreams. And we certainly can have dreams resulting from eating too much garlic the night before. So dreams are not all of the same impact or import. Now, Jung believed that all dreams are related in a very central way to our own development. They all have to do with what he called individuation. And individuation is the process that Jung described where a person, first of all, is involved in a process of differentiation, of learning about all the pieces and parts of yourself. And then secondly, the second part of that is harmoniously blending all those pieces and parts, all the opposites. Even dreams that are just a rehearsal of what you've been doing during the day are important. They are important because they probably indicate a lack of attention to what has been going on. Actually, what I wanted to talk about when we talk about God and revelation and dreams are really more dreams on a much profounder level, what Jung would call the collective unconscious level. They come from a very deep place, rather than the more personal level. Jung divided the unconscious into two basic parts, the personal unconscious and the collective unconscious. And yesterday we drew a big circle. Today, we'll try a different diagram. It's kind of like an iceberg, and only the tip is our what we know about ourselves. And then Jung said the rest of this is the unconscious. But he divided the unconscious into two major parts, the personal unconscious and the collective unconscious. And the themes, the stuff of the collective unconscious, the themes and the motifs, we all share, all human beings all over the world. But we personalize those themes in each one of us in our own unique way. And some Jungians even have a more complicated scheme of layers in the collective unconscious. Dreams that come from the collective unconscious have what Jung used the word archetypes or archetypal roots. And that's where God touches us, and we touch God most significantly. If you take seriously your dreams, sooner or later you will have a powerful dream. And your response will probably be, wow, and I would bet that many of you have had such dreams where you wake up in the middle of the night or your hair stands on end or you're terribly frightened, or it could be a very ecstatic, joyful kind of dream as well, one in which you never have forgotten. And you'll say, where did that come from? It can be a very weird dream, but the dream will seem alive to you. And maybe, as I said, your hair will stand on end, or it'll make you scream for help. The dream will be full of power, and you will feel like Moses when he saw the burning bush. Something has come upon you that is totally other than yourself. Now, how did Jung feel that we should deal with dreams? Jung felt that we should be open-minded and not doctrinaire. There's lots of books about how to interpret your dreams in the bookstore. Many of them are sort of like manuals. You look up, you had a dream of a certain kind of symbol, and you look up in there and it'll suggest to you possible meanings for what that dream symbol might mean. Jung would not support that manner of interpreting dreams. A good Jungian therapist, for example, will stay with the dream images and go where the dream images go. And the therapist will have no idea what the outcome of the therapy or the import or of the dream will be for the individual. With the patient, the therapist awaits the guidance of the dream. Jung never used his own terms in therapy. There's a lot of Jungian terms for those of you that are familiar with Jungian psychology, like anima and animus and collective unconscious and shadow and so forth. He de-emphasized theory and tried to stay with what was happening with the dream and with the patient. For example, if you dream of George Washington, a good Jungian analyst won't tell you that that's your father. And if you dream of a guru, the analyst won't tell you that that's your analyst or your priest or your pastor. He'll stay with what the dream says. It just says that's George Washington. If you dream of a pencil with a broken point, it does not assume that you have a castration fears or that you're sexually impotent. You just have dreamt of a pencil with a broken point. Jung really broke free of this sort of heavy-handed, dreary cause and effect model for interpreting dreams. Dream analysis for him was not a morbid, laborious self-examination of all. That's another important point. It was not for him an examination of all of our imperfections. He characterized that attitude like a centipede who, when he considered how he walked, fell over into a ditch. He thought that what dreams were all about had a forward going, a forward moving message to them. They want to get us on to the next place. They want to present to us what we need that we've not been paying attention to consciously. They have what he called basically a compensatory function. They present what our conscious side is not presenting to us. So Jung was not terribly interested in dredging up all kinds of things from one's past. He believed, like Eliade, who said, life cannot be repaired. It can only be recreated. I think that's a fascinating line. Life cannot be repaired. It can only be recreated. Jung believed that every dream tries to recreate us, make us whole. I remember one time when my mother-in-law visited us quite a few years ago, and she was in her 80s, or about 80 years old at the time, and we had some wonderful talks together, and she told me an experience that she had as a young teacher. She told me about a dream, a young teenager. She told me about a dream that she had as a young teenager that was a recurring, repeating dream for her. And in the dream, she was a beautiful princess walking about the spring gardens of a palace. That was kind of the major image of the dream, and it would reoccur to her. Now, I think this is a good example of what dreams do. They compensate for the one-sided, narrow position of consciousness. Because at the time, she was suffering under a lot of stress and feeling very much in prison in her life, and very much because of the environment that she lived in as a child. And she needed a glimpse of a better possibilities that were inside of her. And she described the image to me as she said, I think this is what heaven looks like. All of us discover that we are quite different in our dreams than we are in our waking life. And we often discover that we are capable of a lot of things in our dreams that we are not capable of in our own life. As I've said, dreams compensate for our conscious standpoint. Thus, they always bring us exactly what we need. God gives us exactly what we need in our dreams. It is God's way of guiding us in our growth. You see, if we only listen to our conscious standpoint, that which we consciously know about ourselves, then we cannot hear or have not heard a lot of other things. It isn't that God doesn't work through our conscious standpoint. God certainly does. But God also works through our unconscious standpoint to present to us other things that we need to know and hear. Thinking about this talk today, I looked back through my journal, and found some pages from when I first entered analysis, which were in 1965. It was my first experience in analysis. And it was a very difficult time. It was when I was in seminary, and I had come apart theologically. It was a major crisis in my life here. I was going to be a pastor, and nothing made sense to me anymore. I entered into analysis. In the first weeks, I discovered precious treasures, and these are in my dreams now. I fraternized with lovely goddesses. I hope I said that strategically. I won't tell you all the explicit details, but it was a tremendous high experience. I can remember the feeling, experience of just floating, and colors were bright, and my whole world opened up to me. As I mentioned, at the same time, I had been feeling confused and depressed, and all those symptoms went away. And of course, I would tell my analyst, who was an older woman, how wonderful she was, and how much she'd done for me. I mean, that's part of the projection that goes on, you see. However, unfortunately, after a few weeks, my symptoms returned. But in that experience, I recognized that I had been touched by the healing power of God, or to say it more appropriately theologically, I had been in touch with it. Meaning that the healing power of God is available to all of us all of the time. And the question is whether we'll choose to be in touch with it. Now, this experience changed my conscious viewpoint dramatically. Because now I knew more deeply what lay behind the Christian assertion that I had believed but not experienced, that a personal relationship with God was possible and could be chosen. I lost that for a while in seminary. I couldn't figure out what that meant. And this was the way in which God revealed that to me. Now, my struggle ever since has been not to turn my back on this central religious experience, but rather to say yes to it and to follow my dreams and my own inner journey. And my experience is that when I don't follow it, it often takes me over, when I don't pay attention to what God is saying to me from the unconscious, it takes me over and I become moody and I become depressed and insensitive to my relationships, withdrawn, up in the clouds, floating around, and I have to go and find a secretary who will call me to the tasks of the day, or I'll just wander off into Never Never Land. I had a secretary once who, when I would get to floating around, would light a candle on my desk to remind me that I needed to pay attention to some of the realities that were before us all. And I won't tell you who that was. My observation of others is that when others have a central religious experience, and if they don't face it and follow it forward, which is a very important thing, not just revel in it. There's a whole lot of difference between healing and individuation. They are not the same thing. A lot of what gets celebrated today in our churches is kind of reveling in previous religious experiences or healing experiences, but not following them forward. And what Jung is suggesting that God wants to do is to follow them, is to face them and follow them forward to their next steps in our development. In fact, if we just revel in them, we tend to become very self-righteous, often very oppressive, sure of truth, absolutely sure of what other people need to go through. We want them to repeat the kind of experience we have had, which may be totally irrelevant for them. And our world becomes very small and narrow. Okay, dreams contribute new things to our wholeness. As I've said or implied, they have a forward-looking aspect. They nudge us into things. They can suggest that we do things like painting or dig in the garden or socialize more. Or in my case, often socialize and do less. An analyst I work with once said that when we have a dream, we need to suspend our disbelief and be open to it like the spirit, with the spirit of a child, and follow the leadership of the dream, which may ask you to do what seem to you to be some very strange things. Things that will, Krangheder continues on in this quote, sometimes you may seem to yourself like a fool, but the eventual reward of following your dreams, letting them guide you, is that you will become what you have always been. Meant to be, and that is the best thing that can happen to you, is to become what you've always meant to be. Now, to deal with dreams, it's helpful to reflect on our psychological development. One of the reasons I like Jung is that his developmental theory is real easy. Instead of many stages like psychologists like Piaget and so forth, Jung says there are basically two stages, the first half and the second half of life, and I can remember that. Now he felt that most people didn't make their switch to the second half of life until they were in their mid-30s. In fact, he wouldn't see anyone in analysis until they were 35. He said it's a waste of time before that. Before that, you need to be out in the world struggling with survival and making it in the world and so on and so forth, and you're really not ready seriously to go inward until you're 35 or older. Now today most analysts would agree that many people begin asking second half of life questions much earlier than 35. I have a daughter who at 11 was going on age 21 and has been asking second half of life questions for a long time. She's now 22. She still has to go through a lot of the issues of the first half of life. She's not resolved those for herself, but she started, I would say, in her late teens, asking a lot of second half of life kinds of questions. And I observe that with a lot of older teenagers now. But essentially, the first half of life, Jung said, is the time of building an ego. Now, that's a very positive word. It's quite different than egocentricity or having the world revolve around yourself, but it has to do with a positive self-image. And building the ego in your dreams often will be symbolized by the exploits of the hero, which is true of both men and women. And often those heroes, that's why young people have so many heroes. Unfortunately, some of the heroes that young people have adopted today are not particularly creative, in my opinion. But when you think of the great mythological heroes, or you know, I grew up on the Lone Ranger and Hopalong Cassidy and so forth. There's some problems with some of those too, because they were always on the side of the good and didn't include the darkness or evil very creatively. But anyway, the ego is the hero. And the ego develops its personal sense of conscious power. There are at least four major activities that go on. One of the activities in the first half of life, Jung said, was to slay the dragon of the regressive pull of the unconscious. And he called that the negative side of the Great Mother, that wants to put us all to sleep, drag us back into the unconscious, from which we come, and are always yearning to go back. Secondly, we need to, what he called integrate the shadow, and the shadow is a word that Jung used for all of the stuff that we wouldn't caught dead being associated with. Everything we've rejected about ourselves, society has told us, you know, like, for example, you maybe grew up in a family where anger was not permissible. That was true in my family. My parents never angered and never angered, never argued, never were angry with each other in public. I don't know what they did behind locked doors. I was never invited into that. Anyone who would get angry around me, that was a very frightening experience for me. Still is. And I will do everything in my power to make you all happy and avoid as much conflict as I possibly can. I've gotten better at it, but I remember when I was interning in Atlanta, Georgia, and the pastor of the church was a chap by the name of Colonel Schultz, retired. He'd been an army chaplain for 30 years, and he was very good at expressing his anger. We used to have general quarters about five times a day at the church, you know, and we went through five secretaries, and of course I did everything wrong, from the way I stood in the chancel to, I mean, nothing was right with Harold. And I was getting more and more frustrated. And finally, my wife said, you know, you've got to knock this off, Scott. Now, either you're going to go over there and tell him what you think, or I'm going to go over there and tell him what you think. I said, well, no, you know. So I went and knocked on the door and said, Colonel Schultz, can I have a... Colonel Schultz, that's what he... Not Pastor Schultz, Colonel Schultz. And... stood up and told him what I thought. Well, you know, much to my surprise, life changed, and he treated me differently, and we got to be good friends, and he thought I was, you know, the greatest thing since sliced bread. But I had to really come to terms with that dimension of my shadow, and I had many dreams about that, In fact, Jung says that until you integrate your shadow, until you get in touch with the content of your shadow, you see, you'll be much too bland, much too good, in the sense of goody-goody, and not courageous enough. And so, actually, integrating the shadow for him was the very first step in a serious spiritual journey. Now, the third step is different. The third task, and the reason I'm telling you these things is because much of our dreams deal with these issues in the first or the second half of life. The third step in the first half of life for men and for women, and many of these go on throughout our life, is for men, it's separating what Jung called the anima, A-N-I-M-A, anima, from the mother. And in dreams and fairy tales, it has to do with rescuing the maiden, for example. The anima is the soul image of the man. The anima is the feminine dimension for the man, which often, because either of culture or other reasons, has been rejected by the man. Now, of course, what most of us men do is we project our anima, our own feminine side, onto other people, particularly women, and we fall in love with them. And that's a good thing. But ultimately, the task has to be that we need to get in touch with our own feminine side. And conversely, just a dream image would, for example, the soul gets born when the hero rescues the maiden. And I don't know how many dreams I had as a young person, and sometimes still have, because getting in touch fully with one's feminine side is a lifelong task for a man, where I'm engaged in that kind of pursuit. Jacob, in biblical terms, Jacob must win Rachel before he is able to separate himself off from his mother. And then when that happens, what happens is that he gets a new name, doesn't he? Conversely, the same thing would be true for women, only they need to separate themselves. They also need to separate themselves from mother. But what they need to find is the animus, or what Jung called the masculine side of themselves. And that's, of course, that's Beauty and the Beast, you see. Or that's the dreams that have to do with this masculine intruder, where you even could get raped, where the animus, or the masculine, is wanting to enter into your consciousness. And finally, the fourth task in the first half of life, Jung believed, was the development of a persona. In other words, a way in which you're going to relate to the outside world in different situations. If you have no way to relate in different situations to your outside world, you simply get overrun all the time. Or your unconscious even overruns you as well. But mainly you get overrun. You think of all the stimulation in a day's time and all the different kinds of people and situations that you have to interact with. If you were just raw psyche, you would become insane in that process. And so we all develop different hats to wear in different situations. And Jung saw that as a very positive thing. That's an example of what you do in the first half of life. In the second half of life, there are other exploits which we can go into if you want in a few moments. But let me say a few things about how you work with the dream. First of all, when you have a dream, it's really important that you write it down and treat the dream with respect. And then you can begin, Jack Sanford talks about living with the dream, or you begin to circle around the dream, what kind of associations do you have with it? What kind of analogies can you find for it, or analogies in literature? And it isn't even so much important that you fully understand what the dream says to you. It's more important to live with the dream and to live it fully. In fact, if you too quickly interpret a dream, then you see you relegate it to historical. It's a matter of historical interest. You can say, "Oh, that's what that meant." But a dream is a living symbol. It's like pregnant with meaning, wanting to give birth to you, new information about yourself, or lead you to a new place. As Archibald MacLeish says about a poem, for example, at its best, it's meant to be, not to mean. It's like you want to get it inside of you and let it work its wonder and its mystery. The essence of a dream is in its being, not in its meaning. Jung says, a dream is its own best statement of itself. The psyche has told you in the best way possible what it is that you need at this particular moment in your life for some issue that you're struggling with, be it a wound that needs to be healed or a new step you need to take, or perhaps warning you about some danger that you're in. It's not a coded message. It's not a facade. Al Kreinheder, this analyst I mentioned earlier, says the transforming power of the dream is the symbol itself. The symbol is the gift of the dream. A dream is a symbol. Let me say a word about a symbol. A symbol is not a sign. A symbol, in fact, that's one of the problems with some of our liturgical symbols, or some of our symbols in the Christian faith, is that we've made them into signs. A sign is something you understand perfectly. You're driving down the street and you see a stop sign, and you know exactly what that means. It means stop. Now, the stop sign may also have symbolic significance for you. Perhaps you had an accident in a corner like that with a stop sign like that, and so the stop sign might also call to your memory all the trauma of that experience or something. So it could also have symbolic meaning for you, but it's a sign and a symbol are quite different. A symbol reaches into the unknown parts of yourself and speaks to you about something that's very important. And things are either symbolic for you or they're not. Symbols can't be created, they can only be found. And one of the reasons why dream symbols are so important is because they're not tampered with by our consciousness or by our ego. They come involuntarily to us. We don't think them up and then dream them, we just have them. They're presented to us like gifts on a platter. And they reach down deep into the unknown of our being. What else do I want to tell you here? Let me just say a couple things about the second half of life. Since most of you are in that. Okay. If you're just to tease out a few of these things, it's kind of fun. For example, you might be experiencing stagnation in your life. That's often an issue that comes up in the second half of life. Or some blockage in your work or your relationships or whatever. You might then, for example, be presented with the kind of blind alley sort of dream, for example. Or it may be time for you to really take seriously your own individuation, to be what God has always intended you to be. And so you'll have some kind of perhaps election image that would come up for you in dreams. Often in the second half of life, people will meet with guides that will be very important to them. Often they meet them outwardly first. You meet someone who appears to you to be very wise and becomes very important to you as a person because they're able to help you with some things. A guru, but then often you'll develop inner guides. I once had a woman come to see me when I was doing, in addition to being a parish pastor, I was doing private practice in Phoenix, Arizona, and she was a nun, and she was in the process of leaving her order to establish her life, a new life out into the world. And one of the very first sessions, she had a dream of this figure. So I asked her if she would draw the figure for me, and she did. And she came back the next week, and she'd drawn a picture of this figure. And I asked her the figure hadn't said anything to her, and I said, well, who is this figure for you? And she didn't know, and we talked about it, and I said, well, I don't know who this figure is either, but it looks to me like a Kachina doll. And I said, do you know anything about Kachina dolls? And she didn't. Kachina dolls are Hopi dolls that Hopi parents give to their children to teach them about their culture, their religion, spiritual affairs, and so on and so forth. They all have different functions. If you've ever seen pictures or maybe visited in the Southwest, and some of the museums have Kachina dolls, they become popular tourist attractions now and so forth. So she went to the library and she researched this picture, and she came back the next week all excited, and she said, yeah, this doll's name is Itutu. And Itutu is the doll that is given to, this Kachina is the one who instructs the other Kachinas at the very beginning of the spiritual year about their role and their task. Now here was the woman moving out of her role as a nun into secular life. She was going to have to develop a whole new way to exercise her own spirituality and her own faith. Now I tell you these stories because this one was successful, and I thought I'd tell you. Anyway, this is the picture of Itutu, and Itutu became an inner figure for her, and she would have conversations with Itutu, and Itutu for a period of time was very instructive about what she needed to do. Now, Itutu is not a physical reality. Itutu is a psychic reality. It's an inner image that's only relevant to her and her situation. Okay, not a physical being, but as real to her as you and I, as I to her. I know that sounds a little weird to a lot of folks. Another often theme in the second half of life is crossing the threshold. Often that will also involve dismemberment. I don't know if any of you have been quartered and pieced or killed in your dreams. You're getting ready to go into a new era. Look at yourself differently, perhaps more wholly, WHO, which also is related to HOLY, and so forth. And then often rebirth and renewal figures will come to you as you begin to work through many of those things. Okay, well, I want to leave some time today for questions and answer. So that's enough of that. What would you like to know about Jung, dreams, and revelation?
The only dream I can dream, remember, is I could jump in the air and flop my arms a little bit, and I'd just float up there, and everybody's looking up at me. That's all.
How old were you at the time? Do you remember?
Oh, in my
81.
Yeah.
What I would have wanted to say is that I can make the choice about whether I'm going to pay attention to God reaching out to me. Like, I think God is always reaching out to us. The question is whether I'm going to consciously do anything with that.
Whether you accept the dream.
Well, yeah, it's a choice to remember, work with them, dialogue with them, live with them, pay attention to my unconscious, and so forth. God is, you know, the hound of heaven, always after me. Yeah.
We just got finished this semester of studying Carl Jung in school, and the concern I had with him, if you follow him through, is that he does not hold God as the God of our Bible, as Jesus. From what I can tell, he tends to move towards the New Age type of thinking. And so it makes me read his things with kind of a mixed concern, not to go fully his way of interpreting dreams, because when you look in the Old Testament, they had dreams, but they also took them to the Lord as to what does this mean, Lord, and have the Lord kind of give them an insight. I think he's right in that you need to be very open to what the unconscious or the black box, you know, that part of your life can be very revealing, because your conscious can be very narrow. But I think you have to look at it with caution, because some people have been misguided in trying to interpret and go off the wrong way, you know. And I hate to see that happen with Christians, because there's also a spiritual battle that's going on with Christians with another force that's trying to lead us off into the wrong direction.
Okay. I think the way Jung would answer that would be to say that Jung perceived himself first and foremost as a scientist. When people would push him on questions of where are you theologically, he would say, I have my own views, but I won't tell you what they are, because I want you to regard my work as empirical, and that everything I've said to you I've observed in the life of my clients and in myself, and I am not a metaphysician, not interested in metaphysics, meaning theological speculation. When he died, he requested to be buried in the church, by the church, in the church. I'm convinced in my own mind that he would say that when he's talking about God, he's talking about the same God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Jesus, as we are. He is often accused and associated with New Age kinds of stuff.
Well, the answer to his thoughts of the archive is, I found that hard to accept when I was studying, that we all have come from everything that has happened in the past, we all have access to that in unconscious with the archive.
Well, that's the whole concept of the archetype.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's a controversial theory, but he would argue that it was an empirical fact, and could share with you, or with us if you were here, all kinds of reasons why he saw that empirically in people. In other words, he had situations where people from all different cultures who had absolutely no connection with each other, be talking about similar things and similar themes and have similar kinds of dreams and so on and so forth. And so his notion of archetypes is our motifs or themes that pervade all of humanity. Now, how those are passed from one generation to the next and between people, But he felt that was an empirical, observable fact. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does that tie in with the collective consciousness of humanity?
Right.
And let me ask you something.
Collective unconscious.
Yeah. If, for example, when I hear you say that, what comes to my mind is, for example, 200 years ago, slavery was an accepted world practice.
Right.
Most countries in the world did it, bought and sold slaves. Mm-hmm. Today, I would say probably there's very few people that would say that was an acceptable practice.
Right.
I mean, where did that come from? I mean, were we taught that, or do we just kind of, have we evolved? Has our collective consciousness as humans evolved to the place where we can see that this is not, I mean, even in the days of the Old Testament, slaves were told to remain slaves. I mean, the church itself felt that that was an okay thing. And now, you know, times now, nobody would consider it acceptable today.
Right. The Jung, you know, that's the whole question, of course, of evil. Jung would say that there are powerful evil forces at work, and they will continue to be at work until we all do the work of integrating what is in the unconscious. Because as long as we leave them in the darkness, then they're free to develop their own autonomy and have power over us. And that a lot of the motifs in the unconscious have both positive and negative poles. Like the Great Mother, which is the great nourisher, also is the great consumer in terms of it's like the negative side, or the masculine can be the very assertive decision-making side, or it can be the war, killer, raper, plunderer side. So, so there are powerful evil forces to be contend with, but as long as we leave them or project them outside of ourselves onto other people, which is the other thing we do, you see, when we beat up other people or we say the evil is over there. Even in our own generation, we've had some wonderful statements by leading political leaders about where evil is. You know, it's not here. It's the center of it is someplace else. So there's this sort of paradox by God wanting us to deal with what is in the collective unconscious, so that it doesn't develop. It needs our consciousness so that it doesn't develop its own autonomy. Racism. For white people, for example, to project their own shadow onto dark-skinned people is so obvious. I grew up being taught by the society that I grew up in that black people were, in fact, everything that white people disdained. Lazy, didn't want to work, liked to be poor. Interestingly, they were also much more sexually able, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Everything that a good, overachieving, young white male would not want to be. So they carried for us that darkness, you see, that shadow. Yeah, back there.
You mentioned that when you were starting that you thought the charismatic had not expanded their consciousness with that. And I wonder if you could comment, dream interpretation could be one of the gifts of the spirit. And I went to some of those services and there was prophecy and there was speaking in tongues and the like. How do you see all that fitting in? Because that would be the modern day revelation that you're talking about, some of these gifts of the spirit. But it's hard to be discerning about that in yourself or in others.
Right. Well, I've had a fascination with, I taught a course, and I taught for a while at Fuller Graduate School of Psychology, a course in the spring of the year called Varieties of Religious Experience. And what we would do is have the students go around and look at a variety of different kinds of religious experiences and so forth. And of course, glossolalia was one of the ones that we always looked at. And let me tell you my own conclusions about that, which may differ from some of you, and this may be have been a very important gift that some of you may have received. First of all, some of glossolalia is learned experience on the part of people.